Good evening. Tonight you might notice that there's a different image on the altar than usual. Most often we have a Prajnaparamita on the altar. But tonight I brought from my house an image of Shakyamuni Buddha, the image of historical Buddha. And I did so because I want to talk about, I want to reference anyway, the round ball that he holds in his hand. And I don't know if the people can see this online, so I asked Dirk to put up a picture of the Prajnaparamita on the screen, and it might come there, excuse me, of Shakyamuni Buddha on the screen. So he's doing that so the people online can see, and you can see better probably too, the round ball that the Buddha is holding in his left hand. So this ball is said to be the wish-fulfilling gem. And the Buddha is holding this this ball, but of course, you know, not for his own sake. The Buddha holds the wish-fulfilling gem for the sake of all beings. Because the wish-fulfilling gem, the wish that's being referenced, is the wish for awakening. The wish for awakening of the world. The wish for awakening of all beings. Buddha, of course, Shakyamuni Buddha, had an awakening. And he... was at first reluctant to share the awakening that he had that had arisen in him, but he was persuaded by some gods to come forth and offer, try to say something, and teach the awakening that he had received. And so he decided to do that, and he shared, started sharing the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of freedom from suffering, and the truth of the path. And he also he taught other teachings as well, and one of the other main teachings he taught was the interconnection and interdependence of all beings sharing a common destiny, you could say, all sharing three marks of existence. All we can see shares three marks of existence. The suffering being the first. Impermanence. And no abiding self. No abiding self. And these are the three marks that all interconnected beings share. So, Buddha, some people thought early on that Buddha offered these teachings for the sake of liberating individual people, that, you know, that it was a way for individuals to become awakened or have the same experience that Buddha had. But as the teaching was, we could say, understood and more thoroughly turned over, it was discovered that the teaching that Shakyamuni Buddha's had a teaching had a had a had a much broader and far-reaching meaning and a far-reaching impact. Because really, the implication of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching of interdependence is a world without war. It's a world where war is not possible. That's the implication of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching. It's also, another implication is, it's a world without exploitation of other people or the environment. It's a world that sometimes now, of course, we have a hard time seeing. It's hard to see this world. But this is the world of Buddha's awakening, and this is the awakening that he wants, that he's holding there for us, you know, in his palm. He's holding that wish. He's holding that wish-fulfilling gem for the vision of that world, the world without war, the world without exploitation. So, having said that, I want to back up a bit. Back up a bit to my own personal history. Some personal history, a piece of my personal history, of a time when I first encountered the Buddha way, or not really first encountered it, but first encountered it at a place called Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. So I arrived at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center in the winter of 1982, and right away, one of the things that you do when you arrive at the monastery is you have a meeting as soon as possible. Well, not as soon as possible, but pretty early on with the teacher, the guiding teacher. In this case, the guiding teacher was Richard Baker Roshi, who was then abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. So I went, I had my turn as a new student to go talk to Richard Baker Roshi, and I had talked to him before, but this was the first time I got to talk to him in the monastery and on the back of doing monastic practice and doing a lot of intensive sitting. That kind of opened up the field for me to talk to him about what was really the most important thing for me. And what came up for me in going to talk to him was to say to him that my experience and one of the things that had brought me to Tassajara was the fact that all my life up to that point, it had been, my life had been like looking in through a window. In other words, I always felt that I was looking into, especially in social situations, I was looking into from the outside. Like I was outside the house, I was looking in through the window. I wasn't in the house, I was outside the house and I was looking in from the outside. And there was something about this looking that made it hard to go into the house of other people and social situations and that sort of thing. So I told him my experience. This was my experience, and I think I kind of indicated that I was looking to work on this. This wasn't a happy kind of way of being for me, and I wanted to work on it. And you know, but I might not have said that just so explicitly. I might have just told him about looking in through the window. I don't remember. This is a long time ago. But I do remember what he said in response. And he said, well, really, all of our experience is like that. Which is not what I wanted to hear. I didn't want to hear that that's what all... Like, I actually didn't even believe that. I didn't believe that that kind of experience was the same as for other people. Do we need some? So I was a little bit disappointed in that response. Because I wanted to hear that, oh, well, you've come to the right place. We have a fix for that here. We have a practice that attenuates that kind of experience, that heals that kind of experience, that'll make you a better person and make you, you know, not feel like you're looking in from the outside. But of course, that's not what I got. It's not what I got. I didn't get like some kind of feel-good response. It was as if I was sitting down with Suzuki Roshi, who of course had been Baker Roshi's teacher, and who famously said, that is, Suzuki Roshi famously said, "The problems you have now are the problems you will always have." It was as if it was that kind of a response. So I heard that this was not going to be awakening was not going to be handed to me on a silver platter. You know, it wasn't gonna be, "It's all right, Jimmy. It'll be okay." It wasn't gonna be like that. It was gonna be steeper than that, and was gonna take more effort on my part. But the unspoken part, I think, of Baker Roshi's response was, or what I take, maybe just what I take from it now, is that he was just saying, study your life just as it is, and just as you find it right now. Just study the experience of, hey, it's like that. It's like looking in through a window. It's study the, and I think maybe, you know, in the back of his mind, or maybe in the front of his mind, he was pointing with his response when he said, all of our experiences like this. He was pointing to, you know, the basic operations of normative consciousness, which is dualistic, which is splits the world into subject and object. All of our experience is like that. All of our experience, it does operate like that. And that's what we're encouraged to study. Study how that operates. Study how that division manifests. How subject and objects don't seem to meet. How there's alienation, how the feeling of alienation and estrangement arises in the midst of subject and object meeting. And I think as I continued to practice, a more determined attitude or wish arose in me to break through the shell of the constricted and closeted self. As I continued to study myself just as I was at that time, I could see that there was this kind of shell, this kind of enclosure. And some determination arose in me to kind of try to break through, or maybe in a more gentle analogy, to open the window and peek my head in. It's a phrase, brings to mind a phrase in the Book of Serenity. It's not quite like this, but I'll use it in this way. Open the window and let in the unique breeze of reality. This takes some work. It takes some work to open this window and let in the unique breeze of reality. But it is joyful work. It is work worth doing. It is work that wakes everyone up. But it's some work to do, to open the window of estrangement and alienation so you can let in the unique breeze of reality, so you can let in other people, so you can let in other possibilities, other kinds of experience being turned by conditions and having that be okay. But it takes some work. And to do this work, you study the self just as you are, just as you find yourself. And this is the kind of wish-fulfilling gem that, sure, he's not up there anymore, but anyway, Shakyamuni, Buddha, is holding. So something happened the other day. Well, it was actually a little while ago. I think I might have told some people about this. Maybe only my wife. I don't know. But anyway, I was riding my bike on the bike path, and I was kind of having a hard time. My legs were painful, and it was kind of hard going. And then I started singing this song. It's a song by a group called The Doors. Some of the old people here who have heard of this group. And it's called, I don't know what it's called, but it has this line that goes, "Break on through, break on through, break on through to the other side." And And I started singing that those lines over and over again, and I was like trying to call forth a kind of breaking through, that just seeing the situation as riding with painful legs, and see like I'm on the bike and I'm on the bike path, and there's this whole environment here, and you know I'm riding through this whole situation. And it was just us, just like turning the attitude, you know, of this is hard to pedal the bike, it's really, oh, it's so difficult, and to go to more of like, I'm really pedaling this bike, and I'm really in this bike path, and I'm really in this situation. And it's, you know, this kind of subtle shift that happens. We studied a text, anyway, I won't go into the details, but there was a line in a text we studied last fall by Nishiara Bokasan. And he said, when it's like this, when there's like some determination arises to break on through, or to open the window to break through feelings of estrangement and alienation and really seize your life, get a hold of your life. He says, when it's like that, there is no second person right where you are. You know, that person who is, you know, alienated, estranged, doesn't want to, you know, cautious, doesn't want to, you know, uncertain of themselves, not, doesn't know what to do. It's like when you break through that, it's like there's no second person right where that person isn't there anymore. And this is a great joy, you know, to break through that kind of holding back or Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, when it's like this, when you really break through, it's like a tiger gaining the mountains, or a dragon gaining the water. It's like you, it's like those beings, those animals, mythical and real, they're going to their native environment. The tiger going to the mountains, the dragon gaining the water. Dragons live in the water, you know. That's where they live. So they're gaining their native. It's when your zazen breaks through, it's like a tiger gaining the mountains, like a dragon gaining the water. Just to practice, and we just chanted, just to practice in this way is called the host within the host. Right? There's a host, and then within the host, thoroughly within the host. So Suzuki Roshi has a new book, posthumously published, by edited by Ju Ryu and Mel Weitzman, a book called Becoming Yourself that we read in the study group. So in this vein, this is how Suzuki Roshi puts it. The main purpose of our practice is to realize what we are and what things are in a true sense. On your black cushion, when you find yourself in its true sense, you exist there. That you exist there means that everything exists in the same way that you exist. The way you exist on your black cushion is the way each thing exists in its own position. When your action in your life is based on this kind of Zazen practice, you will always be in good harmony with your family, with your neighbors, and with things you encounter. You will not make excessive effort, and you will not be idle. You will do exactly what is needed. That is the feeling of Zazen. So I think that last sentence is the most important one. That is the feeling of Zazen. Because in truth, we will not all, even if we do a lot of Zazen, even if we sit from dawn until dusk every day, we will still not always be in harmony with our family, our neighbors, or with everything that we encounter. I propose this in any case. But if we, when we have this feeling of Zazen, this feeling that he's talking about, we know that harmony is possible. That's the thing, you know, the feeling of Zazen teaches us that harmony is possible. And to know, even in disharmony, that harmony is possible is so important. It's vital to a well-lived life, I would say, to have this feeling that harmony is possible. And that's the feeling that, you know, he says, you will not make excessive effort. You will not be idle. You will do exactly what is needed. That is the feeling of Zazen. You may not be able to make all of that come true, but the feeling is there, and that's such an important arising for us. It's so encouraging. It's the basis of, you know, faith. So I want to come back now to the wish-fulfilling gem. I actually have a facsimile here of the wish-fulfilling gem. This is it. I don't know if the people can they see? You're zooming in. Yep, they're zooming in so they can see this wish-fulfilling gem. So this wish-fulfilling gem, or its representation, let's call it the representation, just like that's a representation of the wish-fulfilling gem. That wish-fulfilling gem was found on a beach in the 1970s, in somewhere on the central coast of Oregon, by that person over there and this person here. Walking on the beach, we found this Japanese fishing float. And that's what it is. Back in the 70s and before that, I guess the cheapest way to make a float, to float the net, a corner, the edge of your net, for fishing, out in the middle of the Atlantic, was to blow glass balls, and we found three of them this one morning on the beach, and we've had them ever since. This object came up in my Zazen, so that's the whole basis of this talk. I thought about the fishing float, and I thought about how marvelous it was that somehow, you know, it broke free from its net, and it found some current that is there in the North Pacific, and we don't know where the fishermen were. You know, they may have been out in the middle of the Pacific. They weren't necessarily right off the coast of Japan. They could have been anywhere out in there. But anyway, they lost their net, or they lost the floats that held the net, and the floats floated away. And then, because of the current, they landed on a beach in Oregon. But this image came up in my sitting meditation, and so that's what I wanted to talk about. Because, you know, my wish for everyone, and I think, you know, this is the Buddha's wish for everyone, is that through practice, sentient beings will break free, will come free of the net that they're caught in. That is the Buddha's wish. That's what the Buddha wants. That's what bodhisattvas want for all beings, is for beings to be free of the net, of the grip of the self. Right? So, because in our teaching, our teaching says, you know, this self is caught in a net, and the net has four names. The four names of the net are self-view, self-pride, self-delusion, and self-love. And beings are caught in those four sides of the net. Four sides of the net. And so it might come up. It might come up in your zazen. You might be sitting there caught in some thinking or some imagining of the future or the past or some regretting or some worry or something like that. And you might sit there and sit there. And then there might come a point in your zazen where something drifts free, where something drifts free of all that, where we could say, where your consciousness, where your mind drifts free from that net of self-view, self-pride, self-worry, self-concern. We can name it in a lot of different ways, where we drift free from that. And when we suddenly, and that could come up in the midst of any ordinary period of zazen. And of course, when it comes up, it's quite enjoyable, and it's quite wonderful. And we are so relieved, right? But then we have to be careful, of course, at that moment, that we don't get too caught up, and then immediately, like the self comes back and tries to grab onto that experience, right? And make it a view, or make it, make it part of self-love, or pride, self-pride. Oh, I had this wonderful experience. Oh, I must be such a good bodhisattva. I'm free of the grip of the self, you know. So this can happen, you know. But nevertheless, we can have some kind of pure experience too. That's possible. Some kind of pure experience of just drifting away from the net, floating free from the net of the self. And I would say that, you know, this is the Buddha's wish. This is the Buddha's wish for us. This is what
what is hoped for or wished for. That the people may drift free from the net of the self. So we have, I have some more words, but I think I'm running out of talking, so I'm going to quit talking. But I did want to say this poem that about the wish-filling gem. There's a poem in our teaching. It's been recited here in this hall before by me and by Dora Lee, but it's such a wonderful poem that we have to keep reciting it. Don't fall off there. This is from page 75 in the Book of Serenity. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, floating in the current, I added that, stands out unique and alive. You know, so the thing is that I would just add, you know, that this floated to the, you know, the beach in Oregon on a current that it, you know, it couldn't see. It didn't know anything about a current. And the, you know, so for us, it, you know, we can't really see the current. We can't really see the current that carries us to the, you know, we have the image of the other shore, right? This is an image of awakening that we have in our teaching. So, you know, this wish fulfilling gem drifted on an unseen current from one shore, the shore of Japan, at some point, to the shore of America, on an unseen current, and our practice is like that. It, you know, you can't really see Zazen, right? You can't really see it. It's like an unseen current. But you know, we develop over time. We develop faith in that current, and in our practice, and that's what a daily practice is about: is develop, you know, just riding on that current, unseen current. And letting that current do the work. You don't do it. Let the current carry you. You know, this is important. You know, that we just let the current of Buddha's way carry us in practice. And our practice develops faith that is happening. So there's some time if you want to bring up anything.
Well, Jim, thank you for your talk. When you were disclosing the nature of your wish-fulfilling jewel that you brought, the first thing I could think of was, well, if wishes were fishes... But
how does the rest of it go?
I don't remember. I don't.
Jody knows.
Do you?
I'd have a school.
Over my head.
I'd have a school, she said.
I think it's, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride.
This is why I don't do poetry. I found your description of your experience with life that you discussed with Baker Roshi to be interesting, because I think it differed from my experience, because I always felt like reality was beating me over the head, and rather than trying to get in the window, I was trying to open it to get out. The solution is the same. You know, rather than swimming against the stream, it's far better to ride with the current. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was a very encouraging and buoyant talk you gave. Just fits.
Yeah.
I don't really have a question, so
keep it going. Keep it going. You know.
It probably answered some questions that I have percolating around, and questions I don't even know I have. But you answered a lot of things, so thank you.
Barry has a hand. Oh, okay.
I just wanted to keep things fluid. But when you were talking about what Richard Baker said to you and what Suzuki Roshi said, it reminded me of a session I was at once at a temple. And I'd at that point said dozens of, you know, multi-day session. And it was Samu time, and it was my job to pick these dried bamboo leaves out of the bamboo plants and put them in a basket. And for whatever reason, I hate work practice during session. I don't mind it during a regular schedule, but during session, it's like nails on a chalkboard for me every time. And I was feeling judgmental of myself. I'm like, how many of these have you done? Like, how is it? Like, what's wrong with you differentiating zazen and working meditation? There should be no difference for you. I was like, and then it just dawned on me, like, I'm never not gonna hate this. My problem is that I don't want to not hate it. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a really, I wouldn't say like I actualized that right away, but it was a seed was planted, you know, where I think it was at that point I kind of gave up, you know. Like it was, So what you said really resonated for me from that time. Thank you.
You know, I've been studying the Avatamsaka Sutra with Reb, and he says, you know, we don't have to swallow this whole. You know, so I think that's a good teaching. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's just you don't have to swallow, and that could be. You don't have to swallow. You must like work practice, you know. It must be no different than sitting zazen, you know. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I got a lot out of what you said, particularly about, you know, having problems and you'll always have them. So I had to think about that. Is that true? I'm thinking of all my problems, and sure enough, I've always had them. So I can validate that theory. It's a fact for me. But then the other thing you talked about was feeling when...
That was me. I think that was me. I touched something I shouldn't have touched. Never mind. I won't touch it again.
It's out now.
Am I dead?
Hello? Okay,
we're back. Sorry.
So, anyway. then I thought about one of the things you said about how we perceive ourselves to be separate from one another, and that causes us suffering. And then I thought, yeah, I do that a lot because I've always been a loner, and it's very painful for me to be in groups of people. And I thought, well, that's because my grandmother was a loner, my mom was a loner, and I was raised in a family where everyone ran away from groups of people, and they got so much anxiety about it, being around groups of people, and sure enough, I have that. But I never, so I thought, this is just me. Until you mentioned about how I thought about it at a deeper level, that I feel like there's a separation between me and all of you. But there is no separation. And if I could truly get that, then the anxiety and the fear and the aversion would dissipate. And there wouldn't be so much effort on my part, and there wouldn't be a need to control. And so there's hope, I think, for me to have new experiences in groups of people. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Well, it's kind of like Barry's thing, you know. You don't have to like people, you know. I mean, nobody's telling you to like people or to want to be with them. But maybe there's some karma telling you that, or telling you that you are separate, and maybe that's what you want to study. Just studying that feeling of I feel separate all the time. I feel like I'm not part of them. And it might be as useful to study that as to study the idea of, well, really, there's no separation. You know what I mean? So it's like Baker Roshi telling me, well, really, all our experience is like that. And then it makes me really look at how I create that, and how I invest in that, and what I get out of that, you know, what do I get out of not engaging, you know, what do I get out of that? And then we look at that, you know, with a very non-judgmental eye, and then some answers, you know, some insights may come. What do I get out of that? Oh, that's interesting. So we can, that's, you know, to study that.
And the tricky part is the non-judgmental part.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, yeah, Daniel's had his hand. Hi, Daniel. I don't know if I look there or if I look here. I think
I'll let Rosie go first, and then I have a comment. Oh,
this is hard, but I'm going to look here.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for your lecture, and thank you for the grounding experience of the redwoods during the beginning of the meditation. I have, many of you may know, I have a fascination with shiny things. And I just learned that the most precious thing that we have here on Earth, or maybe in the universe, is wood. Because the universe is made up of diamonds and, you know, all of these elements. But what is true to the earth is wood. And while I was meditating, I found myself smiling. And as many of you know, I've new to meditation. And I, you know, in the past, I've felt like, oh, like, I'm not going to count. I'm going to swim, and I'm going to systematically bring myself back into my body by swimming. And you're like, no, Rosie, we don't swim in the American River while we're sitting on the mat. Okay. So I also have, I have these cysts on my spine and in the base of my neck. So when I sit, and I'm gazing down, I'm in pain. And I felt, when I was smiling about those redwoods, I felt a release of pain. And I thought, well, maybe I could smile a little bit in meditation. And I wanted to ask about that. But of course, it isn't a smile, because that becomes painful as well. So it's more like a leaning back. It's more like tucking the chin. I feel like it's just a release of tension in the face. It feels better than maybe frowning, and I feel better. It released some kind of pain in my body simply by smiling. I mean, is that okay to smile?
It's okay.
Okay.
Smiling has a venerated place in our tradition, you know. Mahakshapa held up a flower and the Buddha smiled, you know.
Yes.
This is very, so, and, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is a big fan of smiling. So you have good teachers who have suggested, actually, that you do a half smile in Zazen, you know, not a big grin, that's too much. But a little smile, you know, turn up the corners of the mouth just a little bit.
Hey, and real quick, Jim, I really appreciated your reference to the redwoods also, and that's what I was going to bring up. And when you brought this up, rooted, upright, immediately what I thought to myself, but where it all comes from is a birth through fire, because the redwood tree is really dependent on fire to activate its seed.
It's like the sequoia.
You're right, the sequoia redwoods. Oh. And that's what I thought of, a birth through fire, and that's really what our practice is too, mm-hmm. you know, to encounter these problems that we encounter on a day by day, moment by moment, sometimes a second by second basis. So I really liked what you had to say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it when someone extends the riff. And people have been doing that in the hall here. You know, they've been extending the riff of the floating gem. So it makes me feel good that you are with me in riffing on the Dharma, which I enjoy.